Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the American Israelite Program, the news of the Jews. I'm going to start off with the aging services, which are emerging as a community priority in keeping with a promise to provide updates on its strategic planning process. Jewish Family Services continuing to share highlights from a survey about community needs. Through input from more than 300 people, Jewish Cincinnati made it clear that aging services are a top priority. Jewish Family Service CEO Liz Vogel said, "Finding information services and care to help people as they grow older can be incredibly challenging. When the complexities of health insurance are factored in, it becomes even more difficult. This issue transcends education and financial means to impact nearly everyone." As Jewish Family Service drafts its strategic plan, it's considering the effect of a societal shift underway. By 2030, 20% of Americans will be of retirement age, and older Americans will outnumber children. In the Jewish community, more people will be caring for the aged loved ones who wish to age in place rather than move to senior campuses. Ann Sutton Burke heads the aging service team at Jewish Family Service. She said, "Social isolation is quickly emerging as a significant health problem. According to ARP, it has the health impact of smoking 15 cigarettes a day." Burke's team is investigating solutions to address this growing concern. Jewish Family Service also is considering how services at the Family Vital Support Center may evolve in the coming years. 45% of baby boomers have no retirement savings, according to a study by the Insured Retirement Institute. Jewish Family Service already offers programs and services for older adults and their adult children who provide care. Included are Star Point Home Care's personal caregivers who help with activities of daily living, keeping people aging at home more secure and independent. CareLink Care Management offers concierge support with navigating the challenges of aging in place. Caregiver Services help caregivers balance their lives while assisting loved ones. And the Center for Holocaust Survivors provides survivors with care management, home visits, restitution, assistance counseling, and referrals, social therapeutic activities, free hearing tests, and safety adaptive equipment. Jewish Family Service also operates AgeWell Cincinnati. Board Chair Dan Rapp said, "Balancing our service mix to address the community's highest priorities is a key component of our strategic plan. It's the highest form of stewardship to direct our resources toward the most pressing needs in Jewish Cincinnati." The Skirball Museum is opening a modern Israeli art exhibit, and it's extending the days that it's open. Those days are now Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and Sundays, 1 to 5 p.m. The museum is on the campus of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Clifton, and it has free administration. Due to renovations being made in the museum, the permanent exhibit, An Eternal People, The Jewish Experience, will be located on the third floor. It's located there. It will temporarily close on Monday, August 19th, and be displayed in the second floor lobby and balcony of Meyerson Hall. A new exhibit, Modern Israeli Art, Recent Gifts from Nancy Berman and Alan Block, will have an opening 5:30 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, September 19th. The exhibition features 10 works by some of the best known and most influential artists living and working in Israel throughout the 20th century. Many of the works were purchased directly from the artists or from distinguished early Israeli galleries by Nancy Berman's parents, Philip and Muriel Berman. The Cincinnati Skirball Museum was one of only three institutions selected to receive gifts from the collection. The opening will feature a performance of Israeli music provided by the Jewish folk duo Irina and Jude. The exhibition continues through January 5th. According to Abby Schwartz, director of the museum, new state-of-the-art lighting will replace the original lighting that's been in place for three decades. Sections of the museum's core collection, An Eternal People, The Jewish Experience, will be reinstalled and augmented with some of the treasures from the B'nai B'rith Klutznik National Jewish Museum's collection, transferred to the Cincinnati Skirball Museum in 2015. While these spaces are closed, highlights from the collection will be displayed in other areas of the building, so there's still plenty to see when you visit the Skirball. The third and fourth floors will reopen February 18th with the next exhibition, Archie Rand, 60 Paintings from the Bible. Well, at the Clow Library, over at HUCJIR, the community is invited for Taste of the Catskills. It will be an afternoon of reminiscing about sunny and delightful summers spent in the Catskills and enjoying the Clow Library's latest exhibit, The Borscht Belt, Jews on Vacation. Traditional resort area refreshments will be served. Abigail Bacon, the Clow Library's cataloging and outreach librarian, will moderate the panel featuring Helene Elkus and Gilda Schwartz, both Catskill regulars. Elkus spent her summers growing up in the Catskill Mountains on her parents' bungalow cottage, bungalow colony, Blueberry Hill. She'll share her fond memories and fascinating stories. Schwartz is from Pittsburgh and grew up going to the Concord Hotel every summer with her parents. She learned to swim, ice skate, and play pickup sticks there. She said, I grew up in New Jersey and have taken many trips to the Catskills, hiking and backpacking. That is what Bacon, from Abigail Bacon, who was the librarian. Although I knew somewhat about the extensive history of the Jews in the Catskills, I didn't know about the lavishness and robustness of the Jewish resorts and the lifestyle they provided for vacationing Jews. From the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, more than 100 car tires have been slashed in the heavily Jewish town of Lakewood, New Jersey, over the past several days. All the cars involved were reported to belong to or be used by Jews. Security footage broadcast by ABC News showed a person in a hoodie using a knife to slash tires. Lakewood is home to a large Haredi Orthodox Jewish community and one of the biggest yeshivas in the United States. Police are investigating the incidents as hate crimes. Lakewood, which is known as the center of Haredi Orthodox life in the United States, has seen its population boom in recent decades from around 60,000 in 2000 to more than 100,000 in 2017. Local officials have predicted that by 2030, the number will more than double. As the city has grown, Orthodox families seeking more space have moved to neighboring towns like Toms River or Jackson. The expansion has created a backlash from some non-Orthodox neighbors who often say their objections are about zoning, housing density, and local support for public schools. But the Orthodox residents and some others see some of the criticism as anti-Semitic. Let's see what is in this week's Parsha from Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. This week's parsha is Vayetchanan, and it is from Deuteronomy, chapter 3, verse 23, to chapter 7, verse 11. And Moses entreated the Lord at that time, saying, "Let me pass over the river Jordan, please, so that I may see the good land." Deuteronomy 3, 23 and 25. Moses places two entreaties before the Lord at the end of his life concerning the leadership of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. One is right here, in which he asks that he be allowed to cross over and see the good land beyond the Jordan River and presumably continue to lead the Israelites. This entreaty to lead, although not made directly, is implied in God's response. "You must command Joshua, strengthen him, and give him resolve, for he shall cross before this nation and bring them to inherit the land." From chapter 3, verse 28. The second request came earlier in the biblical portion of Pinchas and is not at all stated by Moses directly. It is merely inferred by the sages of the Midrash, since Moses' requests of God to appoint his successor right after the Bible informs us that the daughters of Tzelophehad can inherit their father. It is then that Moses requests that the Lord God of the spirits of all flesh appoint a leader over the witness assembly. Listen to the words of the Midrash. What caused Moses to request his replacement after the inheritance of the daughters? Since these daughters inherited their father, Moses declared, "This is the right moment for me to claim my need. After all, if these women can inherit their father, my sons should certainly inherit my glory." The Holy One, blessed be he, said to him, "The guardian of the fig tree shall eat of its fruit." That from Proverbs 27:18. "Your sons sat idly by themselves and were not occupied in the study of the Torah. Joshua, on the other hand, served you well and extended you much honor. He would arrive at your courthouse early in the morning and leave late at night. Appoint Joshua, the son of Nun, as your successor, to fulfill the verse, 'The guardian of the fig tree shall eat of its fruit.'" Hence Moses' two requests, the explicit plea to God that he be allowed to enter the land of Israel and presumably lead them himself, and the implicit plea that God appoint his sons as his successors. Both requests are denied. The first, his children as successors, is denied because his sons are found wanting. They did not have the necessary Torah qualifications to be religious leaders in their father's footsteps. Very likely, Moses himself realized their lack of worthiness and therefore does not specifically make this request verbally. He merely thinks it in his heart, and the Bible informs us of his heart's desire by placing his request for replacement after the inheritance of the daughters of Tzelophehad. Perhaps Moses understands that he himself bears some guilt for the flaws in his children. After all, he is so consumed with his relationship with the divine that he doesn't seem to have the time or the patience for family. Does the Bible not record that he was seemingly too busy to even circumcise his son Eliezer, so that his life had to be saved by his wife, Zipporah, who performed the circumcision herself in order to save Moses from punishment for his neglect? That from Exodus 4:24. Moses apparently is more comfortable making the second request, that he be allowed to enter the promised land. It is this entreaty which opens our portion of Vayetchanan. The entire purpose of the Exodus from Egypt is to enter the land of Israel. After all of his sacrifices and all of his difficulties with an unwilling and backsliding Israelite nation, does he not deserve to reach his life's goal, enter the land of Israel and begin this new era of Jewish history with himself as the leader? But here again, the request is denied. And the Lord was angry at me because of you, and he did not accept my plea, saying that I may not speak of this anymore. Deuteronomy 3:26. Perhaps the rejection of both requests emanates from the same source, and it is Moses who is really blaming himself. Remember that when God had originally asked Moses to assume the leadership of the Israelites and take them out, the great prophet demurred, claiming to be heavy of speech. And then the Bible testifies that the Israelites did not listen to Moses about leaving Egypt because of impatience and difficult work. Most commentators explain that the Hebrews were impatient and had no energy to resist their slavery. The hard work of servitude sapped their inner strength and prevented them from even dreaming about freedom. But Ralbag explains this to mean that it was because of Moses' impatience with his people, because of Moses' difficult work in making him intellectually and spiritually close to the divine. Moses was into the heavy talk of communication with God and receiving the divine words. He did not have the interest or patience to get into the small talk, the necessary public relations of establishing personal ties and convincing Hebrew after Hebrew that it was worthwhile to rebel against Egypt and conquer the land of Israel. He didn't even have the patience to slowly and lovingly bring along his children and make them his deputies. He was a God person, not a people person, or even a family person. He's not blaming them. He's ultimately blaming himself. He spent his time communicating with God and receiving his divine words for all the generations. As a result, he sacrificed his ability to move his generation to accept God's command to enter the promised land. A leader must join in the destiny of his people. If they could not enter the land, even if it was because of their own backsliding, he may not enter the land because he did not succeed in inspiring them sufficiently well. In the final analysis, why were these two prayers denied the greatest leader in Jewish history? Apparently, it is because the very source of Moses' greatness, his lofty spirit and closeness to God, was what prevented him from getting down to the level of his congregation and family to lift them up. Moses succeeded like no one else before or after him in communicating God's word for all future generations. But he did not do well with his own generation. Hence his words are honest and very much to the point. The Lord was angry at me because of you, because I did not have sufficient time to deal with you on a personal level, to nurture and empower you until you were ready to accept God's teaching and conquer the promised land. In addition to all this, perhaps Moses' requests were denied in order to teach us that no mortal, not even Moses, leaves this world without at least half of his desires remaining unfulfilled. And perhaps he was refused merely to teach us that no matter how worthy our prayer, sometimes the Almighty answers no, and we must accept a negative answer. Faith, first and foremost, implies our faithfulness to God, even though, at the end of the day, he may refuse our request. Shabbat Shalom from Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Chancellor Emeritus of Or Torah Stone, and Chief Rabbi of Efrat Israel. Let's go back to some of the news that we have here. This coming from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, which supplies the American Israelite with its national and international news. Israel seemed poised to admit Tlaib and Omar, and then Trump weighed in. Israel's Washington envoy, Ron Dermer, said last month that the country would not deny entry to any member of Congress. The statement appeared to put to rest speculation that Israel might block Representatives Tashida Dalib and Ilhan Omar from visiting Israel this month. Then last week, Axios reported that President Donald Trump told advisors that he thought Israel should ban Tlaib, a Palestinian American, and Omar, who was born in Somalia, from entering the country under its anti-boycott law. Both freshman lawmakers support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel. Congressional leaders of both parties appeared to dismiss the report, even arguing that it would be a good thing for the two congresswomen to visit the country if they kept an open mind. But the work broke last Thursday that Israel was now seriously contemplating a ban. Trump took to Twitter to make clear that he wanted the duo barred. In a tweet he wrote, "It would show great weakness if Israel allowed Representative Omar and Representative Tlaib to visit. They hate Israel and all Jewish people, and there is nothing that can be said or done to change their minds. Minnesota and Michigan will have a hard time putting them back in office. They are a disgrace." The statement came shortly after a Washington Post report that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was weighing banning the two Muslim congresswomen. Under Israeli law, BDS supporters can be prevented from entering the country. Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, and Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, are outspoken critics of Israel and have been criticized for relying on anti-Semitic tropes in their criticism. They're also vehement critics of the president. Trump has repeatedly attacked the two congresswomen, invoking rhetoric wildly described as racist and accusing them of hating Israel and America. Trump and Netanyahu have praised each other lavishly since Mr. Trump took office. And then, half an hour after that report, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency breaks another report. Israel confirms that it is banning Tlaib and Omar from entering the country. This on August 15, 2019, at 11:10 a.m., Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar will not be allowed to enter the country, according to Israel's deputy foreign minister. Tzipi Hotovly told Israel's public broadcaster Kan, "We won't allow those who deny our right to exist in the world to enter Israel. In principle, this is a very justified decision." The statement came shortly after a Washington Post report claimed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was banning the two Muslim congresswomen, both supporters of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel. Under law, BDS supporters can be prevented from entering the country. Tlaib and Omar are outspoken critics of Israel and have been criticized for relying on anti-Semitic tropes in their criticism. They were scheduled to visit the Jewish state this coming Sunday. Shortly after the Post report, President Donald Trump wrote on Twitter that Israel would show great weakness if it let them in. We have some elections coming up in Israel. And here is what Jewish voters find important and less important in the next election. For Jewish voters in Israel, September's election is about the economy, social issues, security, and foreign affairs, too. Meanwhile, while a majority of Israeli Jews support changes to the religious status quo in their nation, issues of religion and state appear to become irrelevant when they enter the voting booth, according to a new survey released by the Israel Democracy Institute. Among the 760 respondents to the poll, economic, social issues, and foreign affairs security were the determining factors for 36.7 and 36.2. Among the secular, 45.5% said that they saw economic and social issues as key consideration when deciding which party to vote for. On religion and state, only 15.5% regarded these issues as important enough to determine their political choices, even though 60% of the respondents supported the introduction of public transportation on Shabbat, and 59.5% were in favor of introducing civil marriage. While religion was paramount for 65% among the Haredi, 53% of the national religious, 44% of traditional, and 47% of non-religious consider issues of security and foreign affairs as most important. A Polish woman who saved adoptive Jewish family from the Holocaust has died at 102. Christina Danko has died. She was deaf and blind, became deaf and blind a few years ago, and passed away Wednesday in her Warsaw home. She died in her sleep in a hospital bed recently purchased for her by Holocaust survivors. From the Depths Commemoration Group, they collected the money for the bed. Before World War II, Danko was an orphan and was taken in by a Jewish family named Kakosova in Otwock near Warsaw. During the war, she almost single-handedly rescued all four members of the family, according to her case file at Yad Vashem. In 1998, she was named Righteous Among the Nations by Yad Vashem, whose website characterizes her efforts as incredible. In an obituary, she was called an angel of goodness and righteousness and a beacon of light in a dark and difficult world. And a synagogue in New York was planning to have a mock trial in which Jewish jurist Alan Dershowitz was going to defend biblical characters accused of kidnapping and child trafficking, and that mock trial has been canceled at Temple Emmanuel. In the calendar for the coming week, the 5th Annual Car Show at Congregation Eitz Chaim from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday, August 18th. On August 19th from noon to 2, Community Conversation, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbors at the Blue Ash Branch of the Public Library. And then Taste That Taste of Catskills, 2 p.m. on Thursday at the Clow Library. Light candles tonight at 8:13. Shabbat ends at 9:14 on Sunday. This has been the American Israelite Program, the News of the Jews. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. I'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye.